Oh, we're rolling, okay. Okay. Still some people moving around in the kitchen, but I'm going to start. I would like to discuss this evening the practical aspects of investigation. Maybe you know that in this practice that we call Vipassana, it actually walks on two legs. And the one leg is concentration practice, and the second leg is the practice of investigation or insight. And so often the teachings are focused on practicing concentration and don't give us a really strong handle on how to go about investigating what it is that we're concentrating for. And so my intention this evening is to help us get a handle on what it is that we are to investigate, whether we're investigating in sitting practice or in an extended retreat, or just in our day-to-day lives. How can we apply this focused awareness that we are cultivating through practice and investigate deeply into what is going on moment to moment in our subjective experience in such a way that we can actually feel the benefits, feel the promised liberation? So this morning I went to my local cafe, as I often do in the mornings, and there was my friend Metta, just returned from Mongolia, which is her other place. She loves horses, and horses are the spirit animal of Mongolia. She owns some horses there and some property, and she also spends time supporting microeconomic businesses for Mongolian women. And she's been going to Mongolia for many years, but this year she went there because there was a 10-day Vipassana retreat. And I thought, how exciting, Mongolia, this amazing, horizontal, spacious place. What a wonderful place to practice. And she was very excited, and she invited me to dinner on Sunday. She wanted to tell me everything that had gone on. But of course, us being present to each other, she couldn't wait. And I had to ask her, you know, well, how was it? I want the details on Sunday, but give me the preview, the trailer now. And she said, really amazing. She did the Burmese-style Vipassana practice, which was instructed by a fabulous Burmese man named U Ba Khin. That is a very, very precise practice. For the first 3 days, the only thing that is instructed to be done in the practice is to follow the sensation of the breath as it lingers and moves at the nose. Very, very pinpoint awareness practice. And the next 7 days to do something called sweeping, which starts at the top of the head and as if slices of our physical reality are prepared to go under the microscope to allow our awareness to feel the sensation of every part of our physical being, starting at the top of the head and going all the way down to the feet. So it's a sensation-based practice. It doesn't have a lot of storytelling associated with it. Very, very simple. And at the beginning of every single sitting, the populace takes a vow that they will do exactly what the instruction is and nothing else. This was not for the purpose of getting us to feel guilty or to give us the feeling that we're in the army now. It's for the purpose of encouraging people to be so dedicated to the instruction of the practice that the optimal benefit will be gained. So she said the first 3 days were hell. She hated the teacher. She was ready to kill herself and everybody else. But as the time moved forward through the practice, something very amazing started happening. There was the translucency. All the layers, the chapters of her life began to become transparent so that she could connect the dots and see the meaning, get the deeper associative resonance of what was unfolding in her life's journey. And being in the state of letting go, there was an unburdening, layer upon layer of unburdening, opening up, seeing deeply, and then letting it drop. And at the end of the 10-day retreat, even though she was in this very, very spacious horizontal world that she had come to often, she had an experience of spaciousness and lightness and tranquility that she had never experienced before, even in Mongolia. And after coming back, she had traveled to Canada to visit her family, where her cousin was struggling with pancreatic cancer, and had spent time with them in that stressful environment, and returned. And a month later, this morning, she was still accessing some of that feeling of spaciousness and unburdensomeness that she had attained as a result of the 10-day retreat. So this is not untypical of people's stories about their journeys on a Vipassana retreat. The question is, what happens that this goes on? What are the mechanisms in the practice that invite this kind of unburdening and liberation? So here, neuroscience is helpful in giving us the evidence-based data that supports an understanding of what goes on. It's all right. Our bodies are an encasement for all of the neurology that allows us to be in touch with the external and internal worlds that we live in from moment to moment and from day to day. And our neurology has evolved over tens of thousands of years and has the conditioning of its original intention, which is to support the survival of all the entities that live in this world we call our reality, including ourselves. So what we carry in our neurology, in our mind, and in our bodies is the accumulation and the intricate mechanisms that have supported survival over this eons of time. And when we're talking about supporting survival, we're talking about four fundamental aspects: avoiding predation, being warm, having shelter, and having food and water. Very, very basic. And those urgencies are installed in the most primitive part of our brain, called the reptilian brain, right at the base of our brain stem. And they resonate very, very jarringly whenever there's a threat that one of those four factors or any of those four factors is not going to be provided. Now, all those tens of thousands of years have not all been in the jungle. I mean, we've had lots of different civilizations, very high civilizations. People who, through that period of time, lived in sophisticated worlds, ancient worlds. But the nature of physical and neurological substance is that it doesn't change as quickly as our awareness, as our consciousness, as our thoughts. And so it is still violently triggered by threats to our survival. Here we are living in a very, very sophisticated world where really we have everything that we need and a lot more beyond. In fact, just last week there was a program on NPR that was talking about the research across the U.S. of A. What parts of the U.S. of A are most supportive of people being upwardly mobile in society? And what do you think the place was that topped it across the whole of America, the Bay Area? So we live in abundance and privilege and portals of opportunity that are unheard of in parts of America and certainly throughout the rest of the world. And yet we still have powerful emergency triggers going on inside of us all of the time. So neurology tells us that the way to quiet that trigger down is to focus our attention, calming the amygdala, the emotional place that gets the message from the reptilian part of the brain that there is a terrible urgency going on. The amygdala then informs those parts of the brain that are involved with our memory and with language. What do we remember? What can we utilize? What have we learned? And how do we tell ourselves a story about what is going on so that we're not all at sea, so that we can make some sense of what is happening? So the hippocampus part of the brain, the memory, and the language part that is next to it gets accessed the moment that we allow ourselves to calm down from that triggered emergency siren that is going on in our body, the heat wave, the tsunami of threat. And if we can calm ourselves down even more than that and allow all of the excitation to really expand and relax and let go and cool down, then the energy in the brain can move to the prefrontal cortex, the executive part of the brain. And the interesting thing is that it moves specifically as a result of practice into the left prefrontal cortex. So I was doing some research on the net about what is the left prefrontal cortex about. And some very interesting and very specifically minded researchers in linguistics and psychology and neurology have created these projects that demonstrate that the hippocampus is explicit memory. In other words, rote memory, multiplication tables, directions, you know, informational, phonetic, informational kind of memory. But this part of the brain is implicit memory, which they call semantic memory, giving deep meaning, giving associative resonance, being able to connect the dots very deeply and reach into a deeper place of understanding. So I was a literature major, and that was my deal. Read a book and go deeply into what is the real meaning of all of these words. So it made sense to me. Interestingly enough, Richie Davidson at University of Wisconsin, who many years ago the Dalai Lama asked, can you please put my chief meditation monks in your fMRI machine and demonstrate what is going on in their brain when they're in deep practice? He, among other neurology researchers, discovered that intense meditators, let's say 10,000 hours, it sounds like a lot, but if you accumulate practice, it's like everything, it catches up with you. Intense meditators have much more energy going into the left prefrontal cortex part of the brain. In fact, some meditators have an enlarged left prefrontal cortex. And the other good news is that it also registers our capacity for happiness and well-being. So, Metta reminded me that the thing that goes on when we calm our mind and our body down is that we calm down the excitation of stress and of survival anxiety, realistic or not, and we move it as we calm deeper and deeper and deeper, like going to the bottom of a lake. We get to the source, and that source is understanding at a deep level the resonance of what our experience really means. The clarification, the relationship of events in our lives happens up here in the left prefrontal cortex. So meditation practice actually moves our energy from survival anxiety all the way up to making meaning, deep, resonant meaning out of what is going on. And that is introspection. That is our capacity to investigate and to see clearly into the deep nature of our lives. So, how does this relate to Buddhism or just the practice of mindfulness? I don't know how many of you enjoy Asian art or have looked at mandalas or tankas, the scrolls that are painted. And so many of them are round and have this kind of wheel sense because, you know, the Dharma is considered a wheel, turning the wheel of the Dharma, turning the wheel of karma. And at the center, at the spoke, there traditionally are, unfortunately, what's called the three poisons. And even more unfortunately, they are represented by animals, a pig, a rooster, and a snake. And in a lot of the renditions, they seem as if they are chasing each other. And in that vortex of chasing energy, they turn the wheel. And the spokes that go out are generally representations of the lives of the Buddha or saints. So these three poisons turn the wheel of life and create this experience that unfolds as the novel that is called My Life, Your Life. And so we have a chance to use introspective awareness to examine what's called the three poisons. Why are they called poisons? Because they poison our capacity to simply be unburdened and be happy in a state moment to moment. And what do these three animals represent? The pig represents greed, avarice. The rooster represents aggression, hatred, aversion. And the snake represents delusion, not seeing clearly. So greed, hatred, and ignorance. These are the factors that go round and round and generate the cyclic karma of our lives in all the different chapters. Now, what do they really represent in terms of our subjective experience? They represent what we feel when we feel threatened. We feel greed, needing more, more food. What are your top 10 greed factors? More food, more money, more time, more phone calls. I apologize, I forgot to turn my phone off. More phone calls, more movies, more entertainment, more family, more friends. So the ability to begin to investigate how we are triggered when we feel violently threatened, realizing that there's nothing really, really threatening our lives in an immediate way, even though we're so charged up, we're so heated up, that we lose control, we lose our faculties. We do things that we wish we had never done. But mostly we poison our capacity to just be happy and accept things as they are. So the greed factor, in fact, is a kind of slippery factor. I mean, you know, we can look at our longings, we can look at the things that we want, that we desire, our attachments, but it has a slippery quality. It goes underneath the surface and becomes our moment-to-moment experience of not enoughness. Now, I don't know how many of you, when you wake up to being stressed or talking inside of your minds or somehow or other being in a contractive state in your day-to-day lives, how many of you wake up to it and say, wait a minute, is this about not enoughness? Am I not getting enough approval, appreciation? Am I not getting enough money? Do I not have enough friends? Do I not have enough time, either in the day or in my life? It's a subtle form of greed to always be afraid that we don't have enough. And it's very, very ironic, being in the most abundant part of the US of A, which is one of the most abundant countries in the world, that we should be triggered with the survival fear that we're not going to have enough. I'm not talking about food, water, shelter, warmth, and avoidance of predation. I'm talking about things like, did I order enough food? Am I going to leave the table hungry? Do I have enough recognition? Do I have enough degrees? Do I have enough rooms in my house? I don't know how many of you have the top 10 not enoughnesses list, but I think if you wake up moment by moment in your day-to-day lives, times when you feel stressed, and say, what's going on? What am I stressing about? A lot of times it's going to be a not enoughness stress factor in the midst of abundance. So being able to investigate deeply into that and see, is this really true? Is this really a fear that resonates with what is happening? Should I be so violently triggered? Now, the aspect or the poison of greed leads to the possibility that I am not enough. I'm not smart enough. I'm not young enough. I'm not old enough. I'm not bright enough. I'm not accomplished enough. These things happen especially when we have expectations of how we're going to perform when we're with others. You ever go to a meeting, sit around a table, and you walk out of the meeting and say, you know, I didn't contribute enough. Or what I said was not smart enough. So a lot of the greed factor ends up in anger, the rooster. And in the context that we're talking about this tonight, self-hatred. Aggression, hatred, self-hatred. And self-hatred leads to the most acute form, the most foul-feeling form of self-hatred, which is shame. Which is a very contractive state. And being ashamed of who we are at any given moment. I'll tell you a story about something that happened which I've never been able to forget. It happened in high school, way back when, to a friend of mine named Sandy, who was not the most popular girl in high school. Lots and lots of our conditioned shame comes from when we're young. And I apologize for this story because it's a little bit of a cringe, but it really has the impact for my point. Sandy was not the most popular girl. She was a little rotund. She was very self-conscious. And in high school, she wasn't the smartest. So one day, the bell rang, school was over, everybody was pouring out of the doors, and I was along with them going out into the courtyard and about to walk home when I hear somebody call my name. In the middle of the crowd of all these young kids is Sandy, and she's on the ground. And when her eyes contact me, I get in touch with something very, very painful, burning shame in her eyes to mine. There she is on the ground, maybe she's fallen, but at that very moment when our eyes connect and I feel that shame in her, I see what she's ashamed of. There's a puddle of urine that's slowly spreading out from under her skirt. She peed in public in high school. Can you believe? It's a cringing experience. But there's experiences like that that we all have in one form or another that get us connected to the conditioning of being ashamed of ourselves. Wanting to disappear. It's as if we want to die. When we have an experience like that in public, it's like a death to us. It feels like death. We want to disappear. We die in the social reality. And when we feel that level of shame, of self-aversion, we also hate other people for experiencing us at that level. We sometimes feel aggressive towards people because they threaten to take something away from us that we don't feel we have enough of. And when we're in that state of shame, then we move to the snake, the delusion. And the relative element of delusion is deceit, lying. We lie to ourselves. We lie to others. Today, I had a phone call. I didn't feel like picking up the phone. So I allowed them to leave a message. I called back 2 hours later, but in my mind, very subtly, I was thinking, maybe what I'll say is I was too busy and I couldn't pick up, when really I was not in a good state and I didn't want to talk to anyone. But I was ashamed of admitting that on a Tuesday mid-afternoon, I'm in such a terrible state that I don't feel like picking up the phone and talking to somebody. I thought maybe I started teasing myself with the possibility, well, I'll just tell a little white lie. I mean, we've all thought about that now and then in various situations. But it's got to do with shame, lack of acceptance of what I was feeling at the moment, lack of the desire to be witnessed by that. Being witnessed by something that we reject in ourselves creates shame. And shame creates the temptation to lie, to be deceitful. So, if we can, using these three poisons, watch ourselves on a day-to-day basis, responding to our experiences in life, we have an opportunity to investigate what is going on. How can I be more clear? How can I clean up my act, so to speak? There's a text in the Buddhist tradition called the Visuddhimagga. It's called the path of purification. Now, I know we're in the Judeo-Christian tradition. We don't like to have these cleanliness metaphors applied to spiritual practice. But it's true. It is a purification process. We eliminate the defilements. We eliminate the things that cast a shadow over the sunlight of who we are from moment to moment, without shame, without fear, without self-deceiving. So does any of this resonate? Yeah. What's amazing is that we're talking about the relative world. In the absolute world, there's a delusion of self. There's a delusion of self and other. We're all the same. We all struggle with these kinds of very, very painful, sticky inner workings. We don't all have the opportunity to go on 3-month retreats or 10-day retreats in Mongolia or anywhere in the world. But we have ourselves and our moment-to-moment experience as the material to purify and unburden and unleash our energy so that it can flow freely and unobstructed by what is called the three poisons. Through this introspection, this entering of awareness, like a knife slicing through cake. Awareness entering into any situation that we might be passing through on a day-to-day basis and saying, why am I contracted? Why am I stressed? What am I afraid is not enough? What am I afraid somebody is trying to take away from me? What am I ashamed of? What part of me don't I want to have exposed? Why do I feel aggressive towards them? That they've witnessed something that I'm ashamed of? That they're making me feel like somebody that I am ashamed of? Most of our aggression and hatred towards others is because of the way that they make us feel. Things that we want to deny, things that we want to hide, things that we aren't comfortable with. If they confront us with it, then aggression is very often a natural response. So just noting, when those times of being triggered arise, which one of these three poisons, what part of the cycle are we on? That is a very practical form of the practice of Vipassana, of investigating what is going on with us, inside of us. In the absolute sense, take a deep breath now. There's enough air. Breathing is finite, air is infinite. We have enough of everything. We can take a trust fall into reality, and it is supportive. Our life is finite, but awareness is infinite. And awareness is fundamentally what we are. So the fear of not enoughness is something that arises from this very, very early part of the brain, when it was really urgent to have enough food and enough shelter and enough water and enough warmth. The urgency that arises in us now is really a lie. We don't need to be that triggered by the things that threaten us. When we feel threatened, something is going on in that inner spoke, in that inner circle. Not enoughness, aggression, deception. And they feed each other. So watch it carefully. This is a way to use the Vipassana leg of this practice, even if you're not on retreat, for the purpose of purifying, for the purpose of unburdening, for the purpose of actually reaching in and being happy. They say that the nature of a mind that is not stressed is happiness. It's the lowest common denominator. It's the fundamental ground of our being. A state of joy. Being alive is enough to create joy spontaneously. Unconditioned joy. The natural state of being. So I welcome any comments, any questions, any reflections. Yes. Yes. Not enough love. Not enough love. That's true. That's true. That's true. Poor parents, right? I'm a psychotherapist, so I know. Nobody ever gets enough love from their parents, or the right way of expressing the love, or too much, you know, the smothering mother. But love is a big one. Love is a big one. But it begins with us. Do we love ourselves enough? Do we feel there's enough love all around? Is love something that is just between one person and another? Or is it an ocean that we're all swimming in? You know, it's like, it's almost to say there's not enough love is to say there's not enough air. Love is everywhere, you know. It's a question of, can I experience it? Can I open up and receive it? You know, dogs are always giving out love. Any moment that you feel that there's not enough love, just walk down the street and see a wagging tail and those bright brown eyes and the wagging tongue, and they stand up on their hind legs and they give it to you full force. So, but not enoughness is, unfortunately, such a common denominator. And it's really mind-boggling, because we have so much. We have so much. And we live in such constraint and fear that we're not going to have enough to get through the week, to get through the month, to get through our lives. So, just understanding that we're at the mercy of an ancient, ancient neurology. And to begin to, you know, wipe the glasses clean so that you can see, what is it that is poisoning my ability to feel okay in this moment? What is the not enoughness that I am fearing at this moment that is underneath all of this turbulence and aggression that is going on inside of me, or between me and another person, or between me and the world, or between me and the president? You know, there's the Palestinians and the Israelis are sitting down to negotiate. And John Kerry was interviewed about it, and he said, well, it's a very delicate matter, and we're going to take a full 9 months to do it. And the interviewer said, do you think that's enough? And this is day one, right? They just started this afternoon already. 9 months down there. Do you think that that's enough time? Exactly, exactly. It's enough time to, yes. Yeah. But, you know, that contracted feeling of depletion, like the universe isn't feeding us, isn't sustaining and supporting us enough. It's such a poverty state of being. It's such an unhappy state of being. And it's so not true. It's not just in the Buddhist tradition. I think there's a story in the Christian tradition about Jesus feeding the hungry with loaves and fishes, manna coming from heaven. In the Jewish tradition, Hanukkah, the festival of lights, is about the synagogue being burned down just when they're wanting to do a Friday night celebration of lighting the candles. And the fear was that there was not enough oil, right? There was not enough oil to be able to have the sacred Friday evening Sabbath traditional ritual of lighting the candles and praying to God and celebrating the divine. And the whole tradition of Hanukkah, the 8 days and eight nights, not only was there enough tallow or oil to burn for that evening, but there was enough to burn for that evening plus seven other evenings. So it's not just us, it's every civilization. You know, we're just very, very tiny little elements in this human unfolding, in this human story. And when we experience something within what Howie calls the gravitational field of ourself, it's very, very heavy. But if you realize that it's such a shared delusion that we're all experiencing through time as a result of being born human and having this fabulous mind and this very powerful survival trigger that is monitored through the practice of tranquility and concentration, then we're all in the same boat. And there is enough seawater to float us. So it's 9 o'clock. One more question, comment? Otherwise, yes. There are, but not us. You know, people that don't have enough, if you listen to their mind, if you sit down, homeless people, sit down and talk with them, they're not talking about not enoughness. They're generally in a different state. But there are people on the planet that don't have enough, it's true, but it's not us. That's right. We can do some comparison in case we feel sorry for ourselves. Or, yes, just to correct that perspective. Just give it some balance. Give ourselves a more balanced view. So let's just sit for just a few moments. I know everybody wants to go, but let's just collect ourselves for just a little bit more concentration before we go out into this world of abundance. So may we all experience mercy in the face of our struggles with our minds and our bodies and the perspective and the insight to understand which of these struggles is truly real and which of them we can just unburden ourselves and let them dissolve. And with the clarification and the energy that is the fruit of this practice, may we experience ease and well-being and share it with those that we come into contact with for the benefit of all beings in all the realms.
Sore knees.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.